Uplus AI is pleased to present a podcast series on healthcare and AI. In this season, the focus is on doctors. I meet doctors to get their on-the-ground perspective of healthcare, understand challenges, and we explore together where artificial intelligence may provide the best outcomes for all. I am Ranga, creator and host of the Uplus AI podcast and the human face of Uplus AI in Twitter, SoundCloud, YouTube, and Medium. I have a background in engineering, and I've been a technologist in the networking domain for more than a decade, working on switches and routers, packets and buffers, wired and wireless. If you'd like to know more about me, go to LinkedIn and search for Ranga Prasad Sampath. I am passionate about artificial intelligence, and this podcast is my effort to bring awareness on both sides. That is, for technologists like me to know the problems on the ground in healthcare, and for medical practitioners to know where AI may intervene to drive the best outcomes for all. In this episode, we are meeting with Dr. Patta Radhakrishna. Dr. Patta Radhakrishna qualified from Jipmer Pondicherry and did his surgical training in Stanley and Madras Medical Colleges. He has had specialist training in gastrointestinal surgery in the All India Institute of Medical Sciences in New Delhi. And subsequently, he has worked as a consultant in GI surgery in various academic institutions in India, as well as India's neighboring countries like Bangladesh and Sri Lanka. After a stint of 14 years in Apollo Hospitals, Chennai, he is heading the GI unit in SIMS Hospital, Chennai, for the past 5 years. Digital media for surgeons is a key interest for him. And on that, I would like to say that Dr. Patta Radhakrishna started the Learning General Surgery channel on Facebook, which has over 30,000 followers today, and we'll be talking to him on that as well. So, Doctor, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So, Doctor, thank you for coming to this podcast, and I'd like to start this off by asking you, now, you are a gastroenterologist, a surgical gastroenterologist. I'd really like to touch upon, in the Indian context, what are the key gastrointestinal issues or illnesses or diseases that I would call that you see specifically in India and more so in the Indian subcontinent that you've worked in?
Thanks for asking me to be on this show, and I think it's a good initiative on your part of educating doctors on artificial intelligence. And to the question about the scope of gastrointestinal surgery in India, I'm one of those early comprehensive gastrointestinal surgeons where we deal with the surgical problems involving the entire digestive system, and that 70% of the surgical work we do is on cancers of the gastrointestinal system, and that includes cancer of the food pipe, the stomach, the liver, the pancreas, the bile duct, the small intestine, the large intestine, and so on. In India, the specialty of gastroenterology, medical gastroenterology, that is the medical treatment of diseases of the GI tract, has evolved pretty well, much ahead of the surgical sciences. And many of the surgical problems involving this tract was dealt by general surgeons. That was an era for a long, long time where any surgeon of repute used to operate on everything, where there's no subspecialization. In the early 80s, a specialized branch of surgical gastroenterology came in. That's when any surgical issues, special surgical issues, are dealt by the surgical gastroenterologist. So, effectively, 70% is malignancies of the GI tract, and there are so many other non-malignant conditions of the gastrointestinal tract we deal with, and there are so many of them pertaining to each organ requiring surgical treatment.
I see. Thank you, doctor. And would you say, you mentioned a lot of you know, GI tract cancerous conditions that you treat. Are there any specific types of cancer that you see of more prevalence in the Indian subcontinent?
Yeah, we see a lot of stomach and food pipe cancer, especially in the northeastern part of India and some part of southern India also. That's a lot to do with dietary habits, smoking, etc. And of late, we see colon cancers as well, which is more of a Western phenomenon, but we started seeing more and more of colon cancers. See, the truth is, the life expectancy in India has increased tremendously over the past many years, mostly due to good public health and development of medicine in itself. India is one of the top medical countries in the world, and good diagnostic facilities have come in. People live longer, and when they live longer, the chances of getting diseases will be more as well. So we are seeing a little bit of Western pattern as things go on. We see a lot of colon cancers, we see pancreas cancers, we see liver cancers as well.
That's an interesting perspective, doctor, about you talking about longevity, and the more longer you live, you know, you start sort of seeing these problems. So
yes,
like you said, probably colon cancer was known mostly in the West, and now, you know, per what you're saying, you're starting to see more cases here. That's a very interesting point, doctor. I just want to take a moment at this time and ask you, have there been any studies done, I mean, to your understanding of why this, you know, there is a trend, if you would call it, if you're seeing more colon cancers, or if you're seeing more cancerous cases in India, and I think you rightly pointed out about specific dietary habits and all that. So have there been any comprehensive studies which have sort of indicated what could be the reasons, and, you know, do we have data on that, public data that's available?
We do have data, but not so very robust as compared to the rest of the world. But we do, and we have some very nodal cancer centers in the country, like the Tata Memorial and its allied branches across the country, and the Adyar Cancer Institute. And they have registries, cancer registries, where they document all the cancers. And, you know, they have some data in that regard. But, well, the data is not so robust as it should be, but there is data. And there are some attempts to find out what could be the etiological or the causative agents in these diseases. Yes, there
I would also like to ask you, now you nicely described the kind of illnesses and concerns that are there of people in the Indian subcontinent and India. What are the specific challenges that you see? Like, you know, when patients come to you, or a large number of diverse patients, like you said, you know, from different parts of the country. And you've certainly taken a look at a wide variety of patients across the length and breadth of India and its neighbors. So what kind of challenges do you see in, you know, when people walk in? The challenges I'm specifically asking in gastrointestinal practice, and the challenges that sort of prevent you or delay, you know, quick diagnosis and root cause analysis.
See, the biggest challenge is the diversity in itself. The most diseases, surgical diseases, especially, say, cancer of the gastrointestinal tract, they have a set guidelines for treatment. These guidelines have been put in place by very renowned world organizations, organizations of surgeons. And those guidelines to put into practice in India is very difficult. I don't think we can put those guidelines in practice in about 80% of the patients which we see. Precisely because a lot of our patients cannot afford many of the investigations, many of the treatment protocols that are laid down. So what we do is we sort of do what best we can. It's a certain, for instance, is a patient with an esophageal cancer, and the convention is the patient should have a PET CT scan prior to treatment. And after that, we give some medication called neoadjuvant treatment before surgery is done. And then we also see the response to this neoadjuvant treatment by another repeat PET CT scan a little later, 3 months later. Based on that, we decide what further to be done. PET CT scanners are not available in majority of the towns in India, and a lot of patients have no access to it. Likewise, esophageal surgery, for instance, is a very specialized surgery, and expertise is still very limited in our country, and that makes it very difficult to treat majority of the patients. So I feel the percentage of patients requiring the most ideal treatment will be a minuscule of the whole, maybe less than 10%, and that is a big challenge.
Mm-hmm. And so that's an interesting point. So if these guidelines are, let's say, have been evolved by some very reputed medical institutions, but if they are very focused on, treatment options that are more expensive or not available, then what do we do in developing countries, not just in India or Africa? I mean, how do you see, or the way I would look at it, what is the role that technology can play? I mean, apart from the advanced instrumentation, in terms of, suppose if we did have the data of so many patients who are coming for this, and if we did maintain that, how could technology really play a role here is sort of something that I'm thinking.
Right. See, technology plays a huge role. For instance, in Indian government, for instance, the lot of surveillance program, like tuberculosis, for instance, we have a machine which will take x-ray of, say, a few hundred patients in a village, but there's no radiologist to interpret those x-rays. I mean, AI helps there to sort out that, out of maybe 5,000 people, 20 of them would require expert. It'll just pick those 20, and then that will be transmitted to a nearby center. And this is the way technology helps. Like that includes mammogram, CT scanners, ultrasound scans, and because those are one of the early where you don't require exactly qualified people at the point of contact. Yeah. And here, artificial intelligence helps a lot.
That's a fantastic example, Dr. Patta. I think that's really in imaging sciences and in radiology. I think AI is definitely making quite an impact. In fact, there was a paper that I read, some time back. It came out from Stanford Medical School about skin cancer detection, about skin lesions.
Right.
So basically what they did is they trained an AI agent with lots of images of patients with and without skin cancer, different kinds of, skin lesions. And once the AI agent was trained, it is just available like an app on your Apple iPhone or your Android. And suppose if you showed your skin lesion or a patient showed it, it could give a first cut information of whether, what is the probability that, this may be cancerous. And it may advise you on further, what's the next step to do? Should you meet your cancer specialist? Should you meet your general physician? So I think that is a very interesting, application, because somewhere you talked about the cost of the scan and also in places like India, the availability, the availability of equipment. But imagine if this kind of an app is available. And today, I think the mobile phone penetration in India is fantastic, right? Even the data connectivity is fantastic. So if such an app was available, I think even in our remote village centers, it could be very easy for us to do at least the preliminary analysis. I'm sure technology is playing a role where these images are sent to a nodal center, possibly in some of the metros, and some radiologists take a look at it. But this is going one step further. This is really putting, the power in the hand of the individual, or maybe the most educated person in that village, who comes to the center and is able to use his mobile phone and tell people. So that, I feel, holds tremendous promise.
Definitely. If these mobile phones, every single mobile phone in the future comes with facility of recording blood pressure, recording ECGs, recording blood sugar just by touching it, I think it's very simple that this can be connected and basic health parameters can easily be checked.
With artificial intelligence, it's just that these diagnoses have to be accurate, which is where the training of the artificial intelligence programs or the artificial intelligence agents comes in. And to train that, we need a lot of data. Correct. So I'm sure with the amount of surgeries that are done, with the amount of population that India has, there is phenomenal diversity in the data. So if we did evolve a good data collection mechanism, of collecting all these different kinds of illnesses and data with different kind of specificities, I think we have a great opportunity here.
Yeah, I hear, unfortunately, I should comment something about data collection. Mm-hmm. I was in Bangalore last weekend in one of those digital media and doctors meeting, and the CEO of KIMS, Dr. Shari Shardula, is a beautiful speaker. He was talking about electronic medical records. He said, what percentage of the the audience use EMR, maybe 30-40%. Then he said, what percentage of you are 90% compliant? Only one hand went up. Effectively, this is one of the saddest part, because I've been, the word data is something which you coming up every now and then, and we are very, very behind in that, because there's so many reasons. Actually, data, or rather electronic medical records, is not very doctor friendly to start with.
Absolutely, doctor. I've heard that.
We Indian context, we look at the patient's eyes, talk to them, hold their hands, and the pen and paper, we are so much tuned to it. Now, when we see the patient is talking to me and I'm looking at the computer screen and typing it out, is a bit of a thing. But then, it, elsewhere in the world, that is coming to vogue, and that makes a hell of a lot of difference. And that is something which is, but then it's very, very slow. When in 1996, I was in Tirupati Swims, they had EMR. After a while, I don't know what happened, but I'm sure I was in Columbia Asia Hospital. That's a green hospital and a green operation theater. They said they don't have any paperwork at all. But very few hospitals in India can boast of this. Very few. We are very, very happy writing down prescriptions and handing, and nowhere these are stored. The emphasis should be on how to, gather data and how to sort of store data.
In fact, doctor, I'll tell you that, the promise of AI is very good, because actually when I go to a doctor, right, I don't want my doctor to be looking at the screen, right and entering my details. I want him to be exactly like you said, the doctor-patient relationship, the touch and feel, the eye contact, that in fact I feel sometimes may cure my disease rather than, the actual medicines. So I think AI is a fantastic possibility, because today you see, doctor, you have a mobile phone, if a patient is able to record, how he's been doing the last few days, symptoms, and he can show you, that data can be extracted. You can have a camera in your clinic which can record how the interaction is. And what I'm saying is, although the video camera feed, the audio conversation between the two of us, the data that I have collected and presented in reports, all of it can be digitized. And if it were to be extracted, actually I feel that doctors like you should not be engaged in typing out an EMR. It should be extracted out of the activities and out of the care that you give to the patient automatically. And that is really where AI is
going.
That
can be done.
That is the future. In fact, I would recommend a book to our viewers also. There's a book called Deep Medicine by Eric Topol, who's a cardiologist in the United States. He's in fact written very well on the role of AI in medicine. And one of the chapters is talk about how is the future doctor-patient visit going to look like? How all can technology come in? And really, I think the goal is we can bring technologies to bear such that the touch and feel that you talked about, the care that you talked about between doctor and patient, that can be restored rather than taken away by technology. I think we want technology to make the interaction more human and humane.
Right. Now, I understand that when the patient comes to see me, by the time all the data is in,
yes.
The thing that's only between me and the patient is a little bit of conversation and touch and feel. All the whatever typing data is already done.
Yes.
I mean, they're done beforehand by the patient back home. I mean, that's
how, and there's a way to, if we have a way to, bring it. In fact, I would imagine like you're talking exactly like you said, when the patient walks in, you look at your screen just to get a digital footprint of the patient.
True.
How is he? What is he doing? And then your current interaction is recorded.
Right.
So that, you have a reference and automatically extracted onto your, whichever software or screen that you're using. So that you really you're not focused on the technology. You're not focused on what should I type in this EMR field. You're not thinking, oh, how should I position this camera? Or you're not thinking, how should I, what else I should do with technology? Because I think we need doctors to be doctors.
True.
Not computer true, scientists true. And technologists.
Very true. See, another interesting thing is that when we see patients, they come with some records. Actually, when come to specialists, they'll come with some records already. But majority of them have no filing system. majority, for that matter, if you take me, I would have done some blood tests over the last few years. I don't know where the reports are. I don't know what the sequence. And many will say that, you know, they got washed away in floods and this. There's no record anywhere. And, you know, it'd be so wonderful that suppose you're a patient come to see me and you give me your some ID, I'll type it and everything is there.
Sure. I think we're definitely looking at that future. I think even in the US, I think there is large acceptance that the EMR, like I think you used a word, EMR is not doctor friendly. That is exactly what is being said in the US also, that the EMR was really invented for billing and insurance purposes, right, not really to capture the doctor-patient interaction. So I think there is a lot of work being done in that side to how to revamp the EMR, how to really make it doctor-patient friendly and worry about billing, insurance and all our other aspects. But we should not lose this. Right. That was a very good you know, interaction. I also wanted to ask one more thing about the role of AI, since you talked a lot about cancer, and I think we talked about skin cancer, AI helping in detecting skin cancer and all. In fact, there is also another mention in the book Deep Medicine again, where it said that the role of AI is becoming increasingly helpful in accurate diagnosis of colon polyps. Right. And cancer lesions during colonoscopy.
Yes.
Actually, what it says is apparently there are many studies which says that because these polyps are so small, sometimes or many times they are missed by the human eye.
Right.
So what they're doing is, I think one of the studies, what it did is it basically took, you know, about 300 different data parameters.
I can tell you more about this.
Yeah.
There's a Japanese gastroenterologist, which I had the great opportunity of meeting about 6 months ago. What he has done is the scopy, or rather the visualization of these polyps, the optics is very much Japanese and German, and so very good. Just by looking at the, in a very close quarters and magnified way, the AI can say 95% chances of this cancer. It will just give the number. I've seen that happening.
Wow.
And some other relation will say 75%. Some other relation say 18%. Without a biopsy. And the accuracy is near 95% when you really compare it.
Sure.
So here, unfortunately, the pathology system goes in such a way that first you have to have a get the patient on the table, put a scope under some anesthetic or some sedation. Then you take a bit of the tissue, hoping that that is the right tissue. Then you send it to pathology. They have to process the specimen. The whole thing takes about 4 or 5 days. Whereas this, it just...
Immediately
it identifies that it's malignancy. This is a very... there's a very 90-year-old surgeon, actually. The gastroenterologist, Japanese gastroenterologist, who's invented this. And they use this... extremely well.
I mean, that is fantastic. Imagine if something like that was available to doctors in India. I mean, we have so many patients. Our population is so big.
True.
How quickly you could really process,
you
know, the different surgical cases and different, you know, diagnosis, how it could be speeded up. You know, it's really the power of technology can be brought to bear on this. Thank you, Doctor. That was a fascinating journey into GI practice in India. And also the challenges, I think you talked very well about the challenges that are and how we explored sort of how technology could come in. Now, I would, you know, talk about the other aspect, you know, a very interesting thing to me that I noticed when I was, you know, going through your bio is you've started a channel in social media and Facebook called Learning General Surgery, right? So I would just like to ask you a little bit about what was your motivation to start it? How do you see that channel? And what is it doing today?
See, this had started about 5 years ago, and moved from another big hospital to this hospital, and I had enough time on my hand. So I just started off, and I found that the Facebook especially is used for celebration and, you know, showcasing your birthday parties and wedding and this and that. But when I was reading somewhere that doctors have started using elsewhere, and, you know, doctors of the same feather, they're coming together and trying to do, then I thought, why shouldn't we make a group of surgeons? And to start that, first of all, I need to have friends who listen to me. So I started making friends. And put them into this, pull them rather, without their, even now I do that. But once they come in there, when they find something very interesting, interesting is not just sharing information, because a lot of information about surgery and surgical disease is there on the internet, enough and more is there. But when you talk about your own experience, the travails they've gone through and the difficulties they face, suddenly people started identifying themselves with this. Oh, this is a very, it looks like my story. And they started, in that's how it grew. And more than the real surgical or medical content, there's a lot of parallel material, that how should you train a surgeon in Indian circumstances, what is the ideal way, you know, how to deal with patients, and how to, you know, learn the right way, you know, because so many people who've been very seniors, they have gone through the grind, and when they give some very useful pearls to the youngsters, it's very easy to, many of these things are not taught in our clinical medicine. Etiquette is not taught, how to dress ourselves, how to deal with your boss, how to deal with your colleagues, how to treat your woman colleague. These are all not there by and large. And again, in Indian context, definitely not there, because majority of what we see, including clinical medicine, is Western. Here, it's very much Indian, and slowly the network grew, and it's become a huge network, and so much so that every day about 30-40 people want to join the thing. I have to screen, making sure they are surgeons, and do it. The issue here is, again, this is a very private group. We discuss a lot of our failures. Professor Tiaji himself talks about, you know, things he's gone through. Very few really we come out with that, because, you know, I think after a certain level, stage you reach, it doesn't really matter if it's going to benefit others. How I made mistakes and how stupid mistakes were made by me, and how one should not make, is something which is not very easy to. These are all things we do, because many things, as we are discussing earlier, not everything what we do is right. A certain percentage of it on a daily basis, it doesn't stick to convention, and there is some problems, but we are gaining from that. And luckily I have hundreds of youngsters writing to me with queries, with doubts, clinical doubts, personal doubts, doubts about personal life. So it's become a very friendly thing. And Tiaji myself came close because of the learning general surgery. Not the Tiaji, hundreds of people, thousands I should say.
Wow, that's fantastic, Dr.
Brought
Patta.
People in fact, together.
In fact, you're calling it learning general surgery. But I, as a technologist, some of the things that you said, I think even I want to join and I want to learn. And I'm sure many other technologists like me who are in, you know, different avenues in software companies and elsewhere, I think they would be interested to join. Because, as you said, though the channel is called general surgery, but you're addressing far more than general surgery.
Definitely.
Surgery is certainly a very good, important point. And I think I really said that, you know, it's very important that, like you're saying, that sometimes you're able to share your mistakes as well, because I think it's very generous, right. I think, of people who, you know, are able to openly come and talk about their mistakes, because they have a grand vision that somebody else should not make this mistake. And sure. Overall, the next patient that walks into my door, you know, if I can give a better outcome for that patient, I think it's fine. You know, I can learn from somebody's mistakes. Somebody else can learn from my mistakes. I think that's a very generous outlook. Considering the overall better outcomes for patients as well as everyone else.
True, very true.
And in fact, in this aspect, Dr. Patta, I wanted to ask you, see, there is a chance, for example, there is also this talk about, in the Indian context, you know, we need more doctors, we need more and more doctors, but there are constraints in creating more hospitals, more medical colleges, there are issues in, you know, setting up how many number of intake, what should be the intake, what should be the, you know, a kind of faculty you should have, what should be a world-class faculty we need. We need world-class facilities. All that is great, but I don't think we're going to get everything there. So I think what you have started, or how you have leveraged sort of the power of the internet and social media to do it, I think probably that's the way to go. And in fact, that is where artificial intelligence and machine learning is also coming in. So in fact, so I was just asking you, if you're ready to share on a platform the data about your failures, or let's say even your surgical procedures. Imagine there is a video feed of your surgical procedure that you're able to share, or, you know, your pre-operative, post-operative, and, you know, patient data you're able to share. Then probably AI or machine learning today, because AI and machine learning are very good at spotting patterns when there is voluminous data. which a human cannot go beyond a certain point. Humans are very good at intuition. Machines are very good at computation. So if you have a large amount of data, I definitely think there is a possibility that artificial intelligence, machine learning can surface the best outcomes, surface the best practices, so that generations of surgeons, generations of medical practitioners can benefit from it.
Now, the thing I wonder is there are a lot of privacy issues in this area because when it comes to sharing patient information, if you see the British, for example, we have a lot of members from UK and Ireland. They don't comment on because they're very, very scared that somewhere it might leak out and they get in trouble. Same, I think, elsewhere in the world, people trying to share patient information is a bit of a dicey thing. I do not know how they are doing it in the West now, helping out AI in these areas, because anonymity is an issue and doctors are always worried about litigation. Doctors are always worried about somebody pouncing on them, and that's one reason why they don't come out at all. I'll tell you something. I go to a lot of places in India, and somewhere Lucknow said, "Sir, about that patient you wrote, you know, that you made a mistake. One chap was that I wrote 4 years ago." See, they'll remember so very well.
Yeah.
See, and these are the things which they'll get registered so very well. So that's one reason why many are hesitant. Now, of course, at certain senior level, it doesn't really matter. But we are worried about your technologies. We don't want our material to go to technologies. And technologies, if you see through that and find faults, is an issue.
No, I think your concerns are very valid, Dr. Patta. As in any other case, privacy is very important. Who owns the data is very important. And the condition of anonymity is very important. But I think if you're able, for a second, if you're able to imagine that you're able to create an anonymous platform where the intention of sharing is really for the better outcomes overall, rather than to point fingers at one another or to gain sort of ego points on, hey, I did this surgery better than that person, or that doctor is a, you know, he doesn't know how to do this, or this patient doesn't know. Rather than sort of fight these ego battles, if the overall intention is to have better outcomes for the patients overall, I think the anonymous platforms can be created. And data privacy, of course, again, details about the patients, like, you know, what their name is, where they come from, what is their, you know, other specific details, I think they can be masked. Even in technology, we do that, you know, because we sometimes when we get information from customers about, you know, how they have deployed some solutions, we do mask out the details. So it can be done. In fact, I would quote the example of a company. Recently, I was reading about a startup, you know, that was founded by, I think, Google's parent company, Alphabet, and Johnson & Johnson. The company is called Verb Surgical. And what they say is, they basically say that they are coming out with surgery 4.0. Surgery 4.0 is digital surgery.
Okay.
So, and by digital surgery, they mean it's not just robotics. It is not just advanced instrumentation. It is not just patient data. But imagine if all of this could be combined, right? And the power of artificial intelligence and machine learning could be brought to kind of, you know, sort of evolve the best practices from surgical procedures. As an example, if you were doing, you know, let's say one particular type of GI surgery, okay, let's say there are about 1,000, 10,000 surgeries done across the world, and surgeons were using this platform. And of course, this platform has to be anonymous. It's not to point fingers at surgeons. If they use this platform and they shared the data, it could be a very valuable resource, because your artificial intelligence and machine learning can spot patterns where humans cannot.
Right.
And they can probably surface the best outcome, saying, okay, if you have this profile of a patient, probably, you know, the best surgeons have done this. Or this is what the most prevalent practice to deal with this kind of patient is, can be surfaced.
Right.
So this company, of course, is a startup. Their platform is not yet ready, and they are still in the initial stages.
Initiative. I think in due course of time, this will come into practice.
Yeah, and I think, as you said, probably in India and in the Indian subcontinent, we need more of this, because how are we going to educate the number of doctors that we need? How are we really going to get, I mean, even if they get their degrees, how are they going to become the kind of professionals that you guys are?
True.
Right? Yeah. So I think that is the challenge.
True.
Great. One interesting question, doctor. Yes, we can build these platforms. We can make it anonymous. you know, technology, I mean, you would have seen the march of technology in the last 10, 20 years of your practice, how much technology has come into medicine itself. But there is always one question that a physician or a medical practitioner may ask. He may ask, okay, you're doing all this. Why should I pay attention to this? Why should I do this? What's in it for me? I may use this platform. Why should I do this at all? So how would you answer that? How would you, to your own fellow doctors,
very,
how would you answer it?
Very simple to answer. Professor T.R.J. belongs to a generation where he thinks it is duty to transfer knowledge. It's duty, because I think this Guru Shishya Parampara is a very traditional Indian thing, that whatever I know, I should transfer. And I think that's how the whole medical system is to... a lot of people do this sort of work just to see, because even in surgery, every senior surgeon trains junior surgeons, and you'll be too happy if one of his students sees him in the airport or somewhere and says, you know, he's doing very well. Mm. You know, that's that you can't quantify the in terms of money or, you know, any parameter, but that gives a tremendous thing. I mean, happiness, and even I feel if one of my assistants is doing very well, we don't express that and people don't decipher that. But this is the traditional thing. What do I get? I don't think anyone would think like that. If I think there are many, many Indian physician surgeons who are born teachers. Actually, of course, that era is slowly gone. That there are teachers you'll not believe who teach every Sunday. Every single Sunday they'll come and teach in spite of...
Wow.
These days, Sundays, you know, we want to take off or plan a holiday, plan this. There are so many surgeons and physicians in Madras Medical College, Stanley Medical College. Every single Sunday they used to come. Not just that, every single Sunday so many students used to come.
Wow.
Students are more worried. See, in our younger days, we used to go to one place, to another place, to another place, just to listen to what the surgeon is saying. We used to stand on something and stand on somebody's shoulders and for hours together. It's because there are great teachers. And that lineage is there, still very good teachers all over. And there are most surgeons or physicians in India, they want to give what they learned. And you should also realize that when I studied in government colleges all through, I didn't how much government has spent on me. Now, every time I sit and work for Learning General Surgery, I think how much government has spent on me and what am I giving back? I think many, many think on those lines.
Wow, fantastic, doctor. I think the spirit of giving back truly hits home, right? Whether it's be a doctor or a technologist or anybody else, I think we really, if we think for a moment how much society has given us, how much this country has given us, and we want to give back, I think this question is easily answered. I think your point about the Guru Shishya Parampara, and very specifically in India, you know, we are sort of, it is in our blood as Indians. We grew up with the stories of Guru Shishya Parampara. I think fantastic. I think that's a great message to take home. And I believe, you know, medical practitioners like you, your voice should be heard so that everybody else is convinced about, you know, this question of what is in it for me. So thank you, Dr. Patel.
I have just one thing to say. In India, technology is developed very well. And doctors also developed very well in their field. But somehow the marriage between technology and doctors didn't happen the way it should.
I think we should set the bar right. Let's say,
yeah, I think
you know, that's a good point. Probably let's end on that. I think the way I see it is there is great potential for marriage between technology and the medical profession. As you said, you know, maybe it has not realized its full potential, but we are hopeful and we think that with the march of AI, I think this is a certainty. It's just a question of how soon, not a question of if. So thank you, Dr. Patta. Thank you for your time. I think it was lovely to talk with you on various aspects, right from the GI practice to your experience in India and its neighbors. And we also talked about, you know, what would be ideal in a doctor-patient interaction. You brought the aspect of humaneness and care very well. And also we ended on, you know, how we can take medical education to the next level. And most importantly, you answered about how or why medical practitioners should pass the torch of knowledge on. So thank you, Dr. Patta.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
Thank you, folks, for listening in. Do give this podcast the best rating you can in your favorite podcast app. Do connect with me, Rangaprasad Sampath, on LinkedIn, and follow my online handle, U+AI, on Twitter, SoundCloud, YouTube, and Medium. I'll see you soon with the next episode. Enjoy.